The famous Doomsday Clock was created in 1947. This symbolic timepiece measures how close the world is to midnight, that is, a nuclear or environmental disaster. Apocalypse, really, sort of the end of the world. It is officially set by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists magazine, a resource that is dedicated to educating the world about global security. And they take into account all of the factors, wars, nuclear arms, environmental issues, all of those things. Well, on January 22nd, so just less than two months ago, the clock was moved 2 minutes ahead to 11:57. It now stands 3 minutes until midnight. The closest the doomsday clock has ever been to midnight was 2 minutes, 11:58, and that was when the U.S. successfully tested a hydrogen bomb in 1953. So this is the closest it's been since 1953. The furthest it's been from midnight was 17 minutes after the 1991 fall of the Soviet Union. So according to atomic scientists, we are 3 minutes from the end of life as we know it. According to the Bible, we've always lived with that reality. Jesus could return at any moment. Barring that return, we could die at any moment. And the only way to live in this world is by faith in God every minute, even if there's only 3 minutes left. Faith in God forms the foundation for a life well lived. We come this morning to the end of the book of beginnings. Genesis 50 records the deaths of Jacob and Joseph, the last of the patriarchs. So it's a good place to examine how we face death. How we face death tells much about how we live life. Our mortality forces us to examine what we believe. Death has a way of focusing life. I know that sounds morbid, but it really isn't. How we face death is really just the end result of how we live life. Death is an opportunity to show our faith. Genesis 50, beginning at verse 1. Then Joseph fell on his father's face. The previous verse, chapter 49, we looked at last Sunday. Jacob died there, breathed his last. Verse 1 of chapter 50, then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. When the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, then I will return. Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. A South Carolina funeral home is planning to open what is called Coffee Corner. It will be stocked with Starbucks coffee, offer Wi-Fi, as well as a fireplace and a television and whatever else is needed. A news magazine called The Week welcomed people to submit a name for this funeral home cafe. First place in the contest went to the person who submitted Time to Meet Your Mocha. And I will leave the rest of the jokes to all of you punologists out there. They had a whole bunch more. The funeral home's owner says that he hopes it will help mourners, quote, get their minds off what's going on. Get their minds off what's going on. We live in a culture that trivializes or avoids entirely talking about death. We want to help people get their minds off death. So people try to avoid facing death in all sorts of ways in our world today. There is such a youth orientation in our culture. People focus on young, and everything is about youth. That's simply a way to get our minds off of death. People forget the young people die too. The anti-aging industry is a multi-billion dollar business today. People trivialize death by constant jokes about it. Zombie movies trivialize death by making it entertainment, very popular today. Now, with me, I don't see why anybody'd want to watch one of those things, but the truth is we see more people die in one night on television than we'll ever see in our entire lives for real. When death is entertaining, it ceases to be real. It's a way of denying the reality of death. Now, the Egyptians were just the opposite. Historians have sometimes called the culture of Egypt the culture of death. They made death the center of life. Everything was about death and the afterlife. A professional caste of priests called embalmers prepared the body for burial. Embalming and mummifying was an extended process. They would pack the body with dry natron, a chemical mixture that rapidly removed all moisture to prevent decomposition. They followed a rigorous process of preparing the body, which included all sorts of religious rituals as well as surgical procedures. Embalmers generally took 40 days to complete their work. And the period of mourning in Egypt took as long as 70 days. And we see that both of those things reflected in the verses I just read. The pyramids. What are the pyramids? The pyramids were actually ancient tombs. That's all they were. They were burial places. Massive tombs for the pharaohs. But all around the pyramids would be a massive campus of death, really. There were all sorts of smaller tombs and ritual worship places and smaller pyramids all around the major pyramids. And as archaeologists are working, they are uncovering more and more of these things from ancient Egypt, tombs and buildings. The funeral business in Egypt was one of the biggest businesses of ancient Egypt. They were really into death and the afterlife. They prepared for the afterlife like no culture has ever done since. And Joseph lived there. The Bible treats death differently. Death is never trivialized in the Bible. Death is the curse of God because of sin. It is the last enemy to be defeated, the New Testament tells us. And Genesis has taught us that death came into this world because of sin. We die because Adam sinned. Followers of God don't avoid death. We face it and deal with it properly in the Bible. The Bible does not obsess about death, though. The Bible does not make it into the whole focus of life like the Egyptians. Jacob dies. And we can learn much from Joseph's response to see how we should respond to death. So let's look at some of the principles this morning. Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph wept for his father. I will say much more about grieving in just a minute. But it's important to notice that tears are perfectly right in the face of death. Over the years, I don't know where it developed, but Christians have sometimes almost given the impression, or even taught it outright, that to cry over the loss of a loved one shows a lack of faith, that you really don't believe God because it's just a doorway into heaven. That is not so at all. It is a doorway into heaven, obviously, but it is not a lack of faith to weep over a loved one's the loss of a loved one, the death of a loved one. Joseph cried over his father's death. Joseph was a godly man. He's honored in the New Testament as a man of faith, but he wept in the face of death. Jesus, in the New Testament, it says, wept in the face of death. Tears are not wrong. Tears are very right. And we can show our faith through our tears. And real faith is seen best in the tears. True love leads to the tears of faith. But Joseph, though he weeps, and though he goes through the process culturally of Egypt's mourning for 40 days and then a total of 70 days, he does not follow the Egyptian approach to death either. Joseph calls for the physicians to embalm Jacob's body. Now, embalming was a part of the Egyptian culture. But the Hebrew word that is used here is very specific. The Hebrew word translated physicians. It refers to medical doctors or surgeons, not the professional embalmers of the Egyptian culture. In Egypt, physicians and embalmers were two very separate professions. And the difference was that the embalmers were priests of the gods and goddesses of the Egyptian pantheon. And they devoted the embalming process to the worship of their gods and goddesses. It's very interesting to me that Joseph did not call the embalmers to embalm his father. He called the physicians, the doctors. They, of course, had the skill to do the same thing, but they weren't the priests who were a part of that polytheistic pantheon, that worship of the gods and goddesses. And so he is showing his faith in the one true God by, yes, following the culture, but not following the culture in that he chose to use physicians, not surrender to the worship rituals of the priests in that embalming process. I notice also that the Egyptians wept for Jacob as well. Tells me that Joseph was a highly loved and respected man in Egypt. He had made an impact on the country. They supported him in a loving response. And he insisted, Joseph did, on honoring his father by taking his body back to the land of Canaan as his father had asked. We show our faith in God by grieving the death of loved ones, not as the world grieves, but as God's people grieve. We honor those who die. We especially honor their faith. Jacob, Joseph's father Jacob, or Israel, whichever name you want to use, Jacob believed God would bring the people back to the land of Canaan. He's in Egypt now. He dies in Egypt. But he believed with all of his heart that God had promised to bring the people back to the land of Canaan. So he made Joseph promise that you will take my body back to be buried in the land of Canaan as my stake on the promise of God to me. It is by faith that Joseph takes his father's body back to the land of Canaan to be buried in the land that God had promised. We have a future. And God's promises are the foundation for our future too. This land is not our home. The New Testament tells us that we are citizens of heaven. Heaven is our homeland. So we grieve, yes, but we grieve in faith that we will be together again one day in heaven. Grieving is a path we walk by faith. Second principle, verses 7 to 14. Verse 7. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph, and his brothers and his father's household. They left only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds in the land of Goshen. There also went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians." Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had charged him. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan, buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So Joseph grieved his father. Grieve for his father. And the grieving process took 70 days in Egypt. We just saw that in the previous verses. Then it was a 3-week trip to Canaan. I noticed that the Egyptian leaders traveled with Joseph and his brothers. This is a huge procession. It includes chariots and horsemen from Egypt. Now, the Egyptians were used to massive funeral processions. Most often in Egypt, the funeral processions made their way in boats down the Nile River. It was their process of mourning the dead. And then they would disembark at one of the funeral sites where pyramids and other tombs and all sorts of temples were located. And there would be a massive procession from the river up to the tombs, the pyramids, and all of that. They would be filled with rituals and worship services and sacrifices to the gods and goddesses of Egypt, ceremonial processionals. So they were used to funeral processions, but not like this one. This one was different. This time they traveled all the way to the land of Canaan, and Joseph stops outside of the land of Canaan at a location that he has selected, and he spends 7 days mourning for his father. He worshiped God, he honored his father, they mourned for seven days. And finally, they enter the land, proceed to the cave of Machpelah, where the patriarchs were buried. We don't know how long that process took or how long they were there at the cave. Now, this would have been the first time that Joseph was back in the land of Canaan since he was 17 years old. He's not been back since. So he's now 56 years old, 39 years in Egypt. And it will be the only time that he is back in his homeland. This is it. I wonder what went through his mind as he grieved the death of his father. All told, Joseph grieved for his father's death for perhaps 4 months here in these verses. 4 months. If we include the trip back to Egypt, it may well have been much closer to 5 months of mourning for his father. Grieving was an extended process. It still is today. We just don't recognize it. In our culture, we avoid death by trying to get over it quickly, get life back to normal, most often far too fast. And the grieving process is going to take place anyway. It's just spread out even longer. We try to deny death and deny grieving as if people should get over it quickly. But grieving is a path we walk by faith. It is a path we walk by faith. Not a moment, not an event. And it takes time to walk that path. In the end, Joseph returns to Egypt. He returns to his work, as we all must do too, for life goes on. And healthy grieving leads to healthy living. Elizabeth Elliot wrote an article entitled "Facing the Death of Someone You Love." Many, many years ago, she wrote this article. It was first published in Christianity Today in 1973. Some of you know who Elizabeth Elliot is. She's written many, many books, of course. But she lost two husbands. She buried two husbands. The first was Jim Elliot, who was murdered by the Alka Indians as a missionary. The second, I forget his name now, but she nursed him through an extended process of dealing with cancer before he passed away. So she knew what it meant to grieve. And she wrote this article. She summarizes the grieving process with 6 biblical thoughts. And I personally find these helpful. I trust you will too if you're grieving the loss of a loved one today. So here are Elizabeth Elliot's 6 thoughts regarding grieving. First of all, to be still and know that God is God. Nate read the verse this morning beautifully for us, Psalm 46. In that psalm, it pictures the swirling emotions that go on in our lives when we're facing the death of a loved one or any other major emotional event. And in those swirling emotions, we need to find the stillness of God. Don't rush the stillness. Sometimes we think we've had enough stillness and we need to get out of the stillness, get back to the busyness of life. But folks, we need the stillness to grieve. It's important, however, to fill the stillness with God, because He's the one who heals our hearts. Second, to give thanks. We need to take the time to appreciate God, our families, our memories. Grieving well, Elizabeth Elliot said, involves the spirit of thankfulness. Can you be thankful? Find those memories you can be thankful for, rather than focusing on the memories that hurt. Memories can heal or hurt, and we need to focus on the healing memories and give thanks to God. Scripture says, in everything, so even in death. Third, to refuse self-pity. Self-pity will destroy you. Don't succumb to self-pity. Woe is me. Why did this have to happen to me? Why do I feel this loss? Elizabeth Elliot writes, Self-pity is a death that has no resurrection, a sinkhole from which no rescuing hand can drag you because you have chosen to sink. That's what self-pity is. Fight the tendency to fall into that pity party. Fourth, to accept one's loneliness. Loneliness is real. The loss of someone we love leads to loneliness. We must not deny the loneliness. You know, we try to deny the loneliness by filling our lives with substitutes, but it doesn't work. So the process of grieving well is to accept the loneliness. A part of us is lost. It truly is lost when a loved one is lost. A part of us is lost too. We can't change that. The loved one is gone, and we feel lonely. But that loneliness can be a time to draw near to God. Fifth, to offer one's loneliness to God. We might think that our loneliness is ours alone. We might think that our loss is our loss only. It's a personal matter. Of course it is a personal matter, but it's not ours exclusively. When we offer our loneliness to God, we offer for Him to use what we feel to help others, which is what He wants to do with us. Elizabeth Elliot, of course, has helped many, many, many people through her losses. And you can help others too in time if you offer your loneliness to God for Him to use. And that leads to number six, to do something for somebody else. Doing something for someone else is the greatest healer in life. We must go back to the living and serve the hurting to find healing. A long time ago, that by the way is a principle of life, a long time ago I learned that when I am feeling down, when I am feeling discouraged, depressed, and hurting, one of the best things I can do for my own heart is to serve someone else who is hurting. It brings healing to me as well as to them. It gets us out of ourselves to care for others. Elizabeth Elliot, in her article, calls this a great spiritual principle that goes into operation when we do this. And she cites Isaiah 58, verses 10 through 12, and I'm not going to read the whole passage, but the opening verse says, "If you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness and your gloom be as the noonday." She points out that we don't have to get it together to serve someone else. The condition in this verse is to pour ourselves out, not get it together. Pour ourselves out for the afflicted, the hungry, and the hurting. And in turn, what does God do? Our gloom is turned to noonday. We are satisfied in Him as we pour ourselves out for others who are hurting. God will heal our hearts as we help heal the hearts of others. It's great advice for the path of grieving that we can learn from Joseph as well. Third principle, our faith rests in God's providence. No matter what happens, death of a loved one, the tragedies of life, life in general, our faith rests in God's sovereign control, in God's providence. Very vital doctrine to hold on to in the times of struggle. Verse 15, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?' So they sent a message to Joseph saying, 'Your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sins, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, Behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph and his brothers go back to work, go back to family life. But the brothers are worried. Dad's gone. Surely he's going to come and bring revenge now. He's going to hit us hard for all the evil. And they did evil. We've studied it in Genesis, some horrible things to Joseph. So Joseph is now going to bring revenge on us. And so they come up with this plan to send a message to him asking his forgiveness. They say, look, Dad told us to ask you that you should not take revenge on us. They pull in Dad. Dad's dead now, but he's going to be pulled into this discussion. So Joseph honored Dad by forgiving us. And what is Joseph's response? He cries. Why? Because he's already forgiven them a long time ago. He weeps that they would have to even feel like they should ask this question. He's already done it. It's done. He's let it go. It's so true to human life, though. I see it often. They are letting their guilt destroy them, even though Joseph has long ago forgiven them for the evil they did to him. The guilty often have a hard time accepting forgiveness. Maybe you've been there too. It's so true to human life. Joseph reassures them, Yes, I have forgiven you. You do not have to fear any revenge. Father is gone, he's dead. We grieve over that, but we trust God. And I have forgiven you. And he expresses the great biblical principle that makes all forgiveness possible. In fact, makes all healing from any tragedy possible. And that's verse 20. This is just a classic verse in all of Scripture. For the sovereignty, the providence of God, as for you, you meant evil against me. First he says, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? This is God's work, not mine. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. God's in control. Yeah, you did evil, but I let it go a long time ago because God had a bigger plan than all of us. Augustine had the classic expression of this principle. St. Augustine said, The omnipotent God, primal power of the world, being himself supremely good, could not permit anything evil in his works were he not so all-powerful and good as to be able to bring good even out of evil. That's God. God couldn't allow any evil in this world if he weren't so all-powerful and so perfectly good that he could bring good out of the evil that he allows. That's the providence of God. And the sovereignty of God makes forgiveness possible. Joseph could forgive the wrongs done in life, the hurts that he has felt, because God has used evil for good. The worst evil you can think of in this world, God can use and turn for good. Can you trust him for that? We may not always see the result immediately, but we can forgive on faith. We can let it go, release it to God, knowing that God always uses evil for good. What did Paul say in Romans 8:28? We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. So give it to God and be free. Let it go. All those hurts, all those evils, all those injustices of life. Let God have those. And He works even evil into good. And you can trust Him. Our faith rests in God's providence, and we pass on our faith by how we end life. Verse 22. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. By the way, 110 years was the Egyptian number of perfection for life. Many Egyptian texts say that the greatest of the pharaohs lived to 110 years old. 110 was the perfect age to die. Joseph dies at the perfect age of Egyptian culture. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which He had promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here." So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. So Joseph lived another 54 years in Egypt. He lives long enough to hold his great-grandchildren on his knees, but in time, his time comes too, as it does for all of us. And as he comes to the end of his life, he points his family toward God and toward God's promises, just as his father did many years earlier. His faith in God is the one thing that stands out at the end of his life. Now, just stop and think about that for a minute. Joseph has lived his whole adult life in a pagan world, a foreign land. His wife was the daughter of the high priest, of a high priest, to the gods and goddesses of Egypt. His children were raised in Pharaoh's courts. He has lived his life in this pagan environment, and yet his final thoughts are devoted to God and God's promises to the people of Israel. Many speculate, by the way, that the political situation has changed radically in those 54 years in Egypt. We know, of course, it quickly changes anyway because the Israelites are going to be oppressed for 400 years, turned into slaves. Many speculate it's already happening because he doesn't ask that his body be taken immediately back to Canaan for burial like Jacob did. Probably because the political climate is much different, and he can already begin to see what is happening to his people in the land of Egypt. Joseph certainly knew the prophecy God gave to Abraham so many years earlier that the people would live in a land that was not their own, and they would be oppressed and afflicted for 400 years, and then God would raise them up and bring them back to the promised land. Joseph knew all that, knew that promise, knew that prophecy, that prediction. It's very possible that Joseph could see the politics of Egypt turning against his people. You and I look at the politics of our world. What do you see? Does it look promising for Christians? I don't think so. I'm sure Joseph could see things are not turning out well for our people. In the end, it's very important then to focus on God and God's promises to the nation of Israel. So he tells the family that God will one day bring them out of the land of Egypt. He will bring them back to the promised land, and he instructs them that he wants his bones taken with them when they leave Egypt, and he wants his bones buried in the land God has promised. His faith in God is what carries him through the end of life. And by the way, it is this moment that is what the author of Hebrews, in Hebrews 11:22, the great faith chapter, it is this moment that the author of Hebrews says is the greatest testament of Joseph's faith. He is a man of faith because what he said to his family here at the end of his life. The end of life, he is pointing them to God, and he is honored for that. It's interesting that Joseph was embalmed. He was placed in a coffin, but he was not buried in the land of Egypt. Perhaps someday some archaeologist will discover the remains of Joseph and Jacob. But it won't be in Egypt. Even many of the viziers, the major leaders, prominent people of Egypt were buried with honor in the tombs and the small pyramids, not Joseph. He's not going the route of man by faith in God. His coffin will be held by his family, yes, in Egypt, but held by them. And hundreds of years later, they will fulfill his wish, and they will take his bones with them when Moses leads the Exodus and take them back to the land of Canaan. They will carry his bones with them all through those wilderness journeys. The book of Genesis, we're coming to the end of it, begins with creation. Did you notice it ends in a coffin? Creation to coffin. God brought new life into this world. He created life. Sin brought death. So the end of Genesis is the curse of death. Genesis begins with creation, ends with a coffin. And that's where life is lived, isn't it? Between creation and coffin. It's all we have. That's true for every one of us. We truly live each day by faith. Steve Hayner, the 66-year-old beloved president of Columbia Theological Seminary, was diagnosed not long ago with pancreatic cancer. After tests had revealed that the chemotherapy wasn't working, Hayner wrote, "The cancer continues to have the upper hand. What now seems clear from a purely physical perspective is that in all probability the remainder of my life on this earth is now to be counted in weeks and months." In a blog post, Hayner addressed the many people who have been praying for a miracle for healing for him. He said these words, "Many are praying for one of God's big miracles, and we are as well," he said. "But it is not how God answers prayer that determines our response to God. God is committed to my ultimate healing. But being cured of my cancer may or may not be part of that healing work. I truly don't know what God has planned. I could receive healing through whatever means, or I could continue to deteriorate. But life is about a lot more than physical health. More important than the more particular aspects of God's work with us is God's overall presence with us, nourishing, equipping, transforming, empowering, and sustaining us for whatever might be God's call to my life today. Today, my call might be to learn something new about rest. Today, my call might be to encourage another person in some very tangible way. Today, my call might be to learn something new about patience, endurance, and the identification with those who suffer. Today, my call might be to mull through a new insight about God's truth or character." He closed, quoting the poet E.E. Cummings, he closed his blog post, "I thank you, God, for this most amazing day." That's faith. Talking to Dad, just again last night, focusing on each day, talking about who he prays for, many in this congregation, many pastors and preachers and missionaries, talking about the notes of encouragement he writes to people. What's he doing? Today, God's call on my life. That's how you end life well. A new product called Ticker is a wristwatch that counts down your life so you can make every second count. Available, I guess, as early as last April 2014, thousands of pre-orders, and I don't know how many they've sold since. Ticker allows you to watch as a dot matrix screen displays the seconds you have left on Earth as they disappear down a black hole. Your estimated time of death is, of course, just an estimate. Ticker uses an algorithm like the one used by the federal government. You know, you enter in that data. Maybe you've done this. You enter in the data, and it spits out how long you have to live or what the numbers should be for your life expectancy. So Ticker uses that, converts that into a countdown of the years, months, days, minutes, and seconds you have left on this earth. And the effect is this sobering sort of grim reaper on your wrist that watches your life going down this black hole. Ticker's inventor is a 37-year-old Swede named Frederick Colting. He says he invented the gadget not as a morbid novelty item, but as a real, genuine attempt to change his own thinking about death. Colting, a former gravedigger himself, said, "The occurrence of death is no surprise to anyone, but in our modern society, we rarely talk about it. I think that if we were more aware of our own expiration, I'm sure we'd make better choices while we are alive." That's why he calls Ticker the happiness watch. It's his belief that watching your life slip away will remind you to savor life while you have it. Well, I personally don't have any desire to wear a watch that watches and watch my life slip away into this symbolic black hole and remind me about all of that. But I can tell you this: God has my days numbered and yours too. It is appointed unto a soul once to die. Appointed. So let's make each day count for him and live a life well lived. Today, what's God's call on your life? Today, how will you live for him? Father, we don't like topics like these, Lord, but they're part of your word and they teach us to be ready. Help us to walk each day by faith in you, to make use of each moment, and to look for your call on our lives for today. And Father, I pray for those who grieve and hurt. The death of loved ones is hard. Comfort, strengthen, and help us each to learn to live every day by faith in you. In Jesus' name, amen. We can think